This is Treasury Matters, the podcast from Alma. Each week through this series, we will be joined by a leading industry voice to talk all things Treasury. This week, we talk to David McDonald, who is not only a capital and treasury expert, but he also teaches for UK ALMA.
Welcome, David. Fantastic to have you on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Before we go on to the heart of our conversation, can you tell me how you got into finance, banking, treasury and capital management?
Firstly, delighted to be here, Chris. Thanks very much for having me on. And I'll try and be as interesting as possible about something which is possibly a little dry sometimes, although very, very exciting at the best of times. So how did I get into banking? Well, I was doing really very little in the late 80s and playing in a band, actually, and my hair started to fall out. And I thought, I don't want to be like Phil Collins or Elton John. I mean, clearly Elton John subsequently got hair, but at the time he didn't have any. And I thought, I don't want to be like them. I'm going to go and do something else. And at that time in London, by far the easiest job to get was in financial services, because financial services was huge. We'd had Big Bang in 87. I'll say that again. And there were lots of jobs around, and it was very easy to get temp work in banks. So I temped for a while. Then I went off to India for 6 months and had a nice time there. And I came back and I temped again. And eventually people sort of said, well, you know, why don't you settle down? You know, we'll give you a full-time job. And so I thought, well, all right, I'll do that. And worked for Kleinwort Benson, who had been the biggest merchant bank in the city in the 80s. And they'd managed all the conservatives' privatisation. So they did the, sort of admin and the IPOs of water and telecoms and all the rest, and became a very fat bank. But they weren't doing so well in the early 90s. But I joined them and I worked for them for 3 or 4 years. After that, I'd sort of had enough and took a year out and flew my kite on Clapham Common. And then I thought, oh, I do need to get a job. All my hair's fallen out now. And I remember my mother kept saying to me, you'll never get a wife if you don't get a job. and I said, all right, I'll go and get a job. And I got a job. And she said, oh, your hair's falling out. You won't get a wife anyway. She grew up in that sort of post-war austere sort of British family that didn't want to say anything positive. But it meant that I got a job in banking. So having worked for Kleinwort for a few years, I got a job with HSBC. I went in as a temp and I really got on with them, you know, and they thought I was smart, and they said, why don't you apply for a job? I said, yeah, okay. And one came up and I joined them, and I was there for 16 years. And it was a long time. It's probably too long, actually. But I worked for them, and it was a fantastic company to work for. They seconded me over to Hong Kong for 3 years and gave me a flat and an expense account and free holidays around the region. You know, and they worked me quite hard, but not too hard. And I worked in finance in Hong Kong and in risk, basically doing MI systems, generally around calculating capital requirements, but also around exposure. And I got to, I was very lucky because I arrived there at the point where the Asian crisis happened, and suddenly all the banks in Asia were overextended, companies were going bust all over the place, exchange. I mean, the weirdest things happened in Asia during the Asian crisis. I mean, one example was we had a treasury trading system in HSBC, which was called TREATS, which stood for Treasury Trading System. And HSBC built it all its own systems. It didn't buy anything. It built them all itself. And it had a system called TREATS. And they suddenly realized that the Indonesian rupiah had fallen so far against the US dollar that this system didn't have enough spaces in its register for currency to record the exchange rate, and therefore couldn't actually work as a treasury system. So they sent a whole team of people over to Jakarta to sort of work 24/7 to fix this. And they did. And I think that was the message of the Asian crisis, is that things went horribly wrong, but they didn't go so horribly wrong that governments had to intervene and you know, horrible recessions followed. It was more, oh, we've lent too much. We haven't been very good on credit. We've lost a load of money. Okay, let's absorb that within our capital reserves and move on. So then I stayed at HSBC till 2011, and most of my work there was back in the UK, working in head office in mostly in risk, implementing Basel II, which was this massive change program in the mid noughties. Where people really had to, we had the opportunity to roll out IRB models and AMA models for operational risk. And that required the group to invest something like $250 million in new systems and rollouts and new practices, risk management, rating systems, models, right the way around the world. It was a huge program, and my favorite story about that, actually, Chris, if you don't mind if I digress slightly, was the first meeting on this new capital adequacy framework, it was called at the time, when the consultation paper came out from the Basel Committee. And there was a meeting with the CEO of the bank, of the group, who shall remain nameless for the purposes of this podcast, but it was in 2004. And the sort of senior credit guy in credit and chief accountant and one or two other people went up to have this meeting to brief the CEO on what the regulators were saying that banks needed to do. And He didn't know much about it. He wasn't really, he was a, you know, seasoned banker, really understood his business, really understood credit. And they explained it to him and they said, well, what the regulators are saying is that you need to have models in place for all of your risk, bank risk, corporate risk, retail risk, market risk, operational risk. And these models will then be used to determine how much capital you need. And my boss was a guy called Jim, and he had worked at the PRA, or the then FSA, as a secondee doing credit reports for about 6 months, and he'd just come back to run this program. And after about 15 minutes, the CEO looked up at the room and understood what this was all about. This was all about using models and computers to assess risk, which was completely anathema to him. And he said, Jim, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to go and see your friends at the FSA. And I want you to tell them to And then he said, I do not want to have another meeting on this subject. Go away and do what you have to do. But you know what what's being suggested here is completely ridiculous. There was never a CEO's steering committee for Basel II. We weren't even allowed to call it the Basel II program. We had to call it the Strategic Finance and Risk Systems Project. So that no one at the top actually knew what we were doing, even though we knew that we had no choice and we had to do it. We managed to get the investment budget by saying, oh, we've got this new system we need to roll out. We've got this, you know, sort of group of people we need to train in Canada. It wasn't really until that CEO, I don't know when he retired, but it was certainly before the global financial crisis, because they all left in 2007, didn't they? So he left, and then we were able to say, yes, this is the Basel II program, we can come out of the closet and explain what we're really doing. So anyway, I digress. So I worked for HSBC until 2011, and then I got a, I left. I think it was on the 11th of November 2011. That's how I remember it. I didn't walk out of the office at 11 o'clock, but that would have been perfect. And then I'd already got a job at Santander, working for them as director of capital management. And their real issue was they were a very, very similar group to HSBC, a sort of federated global organization. All the subsidiaries had to stand alone on capital and liquidity, and made a lot of money. I mean, they sort of made a lot of money. That's what they did. That's what Santander and HSBC did very well. And their key challenge was, didn't really happen until after I got there. I was there for a couple of years trying to roll out models, trying to get portfolios onto the IRB approach to save capital so that we could invest that surplus capital somewhere else in the world, generally Brazil, because Brazil was doing so well. And then we had the euro crisis, and Portugal, Italy, Greece, Spain, and Ireland, I think, the pigs. Is that right? Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, Spain, yes. And it was a major crisis. I mean, we kind of forget about it. We talk about the global financial crisis in 2007-09, but the real crisis in for Santander and for European banks was this European crisis where, you know, the southern nations had borrowed far too much money since joining the euro and built this wonderful infrastructure. Lots of roads and tunnels and airports, and but they couldn't pay the money back. So that became a problem in Europe, and then the European Central Bank took over the regulation of banks from the national supervisors through the single supervisory mechanism. And the big issue for all European banks was how to get their capital ratios up. We know in the UK that the FSA, now PRA, had worked very hard to get banks' capital ratios up to 12, 13, 14%. Well, the Europeans hadn't done that. And this crisis prompted the SSM and national supervisors generally to start pushing those capital ratios up. So Santander needed to do that. And I was part of the team coordinated from Madrid to bring in initiatives to push that ratio up. And we worked very hard over 3 or 4 years to do that. And through optimizations for educating the business around return on capital. I mean, most people in the business, and they're probably a bit more aware today, but back then, you know, you didn't really look at what the return on equity was of a transaction you were doing. You looked at how much P&L it's going to generate, regardless of how much balance sheet you're using or capital you're using to generate that P&L. It's like, well, you know, we're only doing this at an eighth margin, but it's going to be worth, you know, sort of £400,000 income a year in this corporate banking centre in Bradford, and therefore we need to do it. But actually, you're destroying value if you do that transaction. So we had to do a lot of work around that. And then SRT securitizations. We did six SRT securitizations, which are pretty serious trades where you're essentially selling the risk in a way that the regulators can give you a capital benefit.
Just for the audience, an SRT is what?
So SRT stands for Significant Risk Transfer. And it was arguably one of the main causes of the global financial crisis because banks would sell a portfolio of risk to investors. And when those loans went bad, the idea was that the investors would bear the risk and the banks wouldn't take a loss. And therefore, they didn't need to hold as much capital because the investors' capital was supporting that portfolio. What happened in practice was that there were all sorts of loopholes that meant that the investors never had to pay to compensate the bank for the risk. And the bank ended up taking most, if not all, of the losses on those transactions. And we know, of course, that the CDOs or the CLOs, that the subprime mortgage bonds that were the cause, the initial root of the crisis itself, were very much structured in that way, and that loans were bundled up into securitizations and sold to investors, insured by insurance companies who couldn't possibly pay up on the insurance, because if they did, they would go bust. And so it appears that either regulators, rating agencies, banks and investors simply didn't understand any of these instruments, or maybe they did understand them, but they thought, well, this is a gravy train and we're just going to keep riding on it till it crashes. And I think probably the latter was true, because one of the biggest findings from the global financial crisis, apart from all the new liquidity and capital rules and market risk rules and counterparty credit risk rules, one of the biggest things that's come out of that is accountability rules. Boards would say, well, we didn't know what the traders were doing. You know, we didn't have that risk appetite. And the traders would say, well, we didn't know what the board's risk appetite was, you know. And so no one was accountable. Nobody went to jail. And everyone said, well, it was someone else's fault. So the biggest thing that came out of the global financial crisis was accountability rules, where there is individual senior manager function accountability within a firm for capital, for liquidity, for ICAP, ILAP, stress testing, conduct, and all sorts of other things, where an individual at the top of a bank and a board director and a non-executive director have specified accountability, so that something goes wrong, it's their fault. Even if they didn't know what was going on, it's their fault, because their job is to know what's going on and to be accountable and make sure that they're conducting their business in a prudent and or not in a reckless way, I think is the best way to put it. So I think that's the biggest thing that came out of the global financial crisis. But one other thing that came out was that the securitization market basically closed for about 6 years in the UK. And it started to come back just after the euro crisis. So we were an early adopter in order to help the group get its capital ratio up and got into some fairly big securitizations of assets on the balance sheet. It was an interesting time. Not all of the securitizations that we launched were met with the PRA's approval, because everyone was still finding their way and the rules weren't very clear. And the way the regulator set up the rules, particularly in the UK, was they said, look, here's some guidelines. Do your securitization. We will not give you approval for it. We'll look at it after you've launched the securitization, and then we'll tell you whether we like it or not. So you're running the risk of doing this big transaction, and they're not cheap. You know, they're sort of $5 million to get them done. And because you've got all the legals, you've got the investment bankers taking their cut and doing the work to get the investors on board, and you're paying quite a big coupon on a SRT trade. So yeah, it's a big risk. But you know, lawyers are wonderful, and what the legal world did with SRTs is they put a regulatory break clause into each SRT trade, which basically said, well, if the regulator says we don't like it, then we can call the trade after 9 months. Everyone's happy because investors get 9 months of a wonderful coupon, and then they don't have the risk anymore, and the bank doesn't have to pay a massive coupon for 5 years or until the loans have actually amortized off. So that's a nice little compromise that you can do on an SRT trade. And then there were other banks who launched some fairly racy SRTs, and we did hear of one bank that was told by the regulator, you're not to do any more of these. So that, and there was a kind of three strikes and you're out rule. So that all goes on in the background. If you look through the supervisory statement on significant risk transfer securitizations from the PRA, none of that's in there. But the rules are a lot clearer now than they were then. So I think people are probably better aware of what's likely to pass muster and what isn't.
David, you talked about sort of how the world has changed. I mean, I'm going to say we start with sort of the Basel I Accord at this, and everyone says about 8% around the 1988 level. And then we've moved to all these internal models and advanced internal risk-based modelling from sort of onwards from about 2004. The global financial crisis occurs, and it seems like everyone's the models have told you have lower and lower RWAs, and the leverage in banks went ever higher, and the returns got ever better. And your point was, you know, the gravy train seemed to be working, nothing seemed to be blowing up, but finally it does. And ever since then, sort of Basel III came in, and in essence, most of it has been around getting more and better capital into banks. Do you want to tell us through that's sort of has been ongoing now, and we finally now find ourselves at sort of the supposed last leg of these things, Basel III reform? Is it called Basel IV? Is it Basel 3.1? I don't know how you want to think about it, but what do you call it for yourself, and how do you think about that at the moment? And more to the point, is it overdone, and are banks investable? So do you want to take us through how you think about those things?
So, I mean, a few questions there, Chris. I mean, they're all good questions. I think the first thing to say, and the first thing that struck me, was that there is this idea that Basel II and internal models and banks driving down their capital requirements somehow contributed to the global financial crisis. And that, I think, is a myth. Because Basel II wasn't approved until after that crisis happened. So all of the things that had caused the build-up to the financial crisis, Basel I was in force. You could possibly argue that banks' capital plans, based upon having more capital, gave them the freedom to invest more capital in subprime bonds and the like. But I don't think that's true. I don't think that that Basel II contributed at all to the global financial crisis. And in fact, if you look at the US, where the crisis started, they weren't allowed to use Basel II. So they had to have all the models, but they weren't actually allowed to release any capital. So I think that's a bit of a myth. But you had the global financial crisis at roughly the same time as European banks and UK banks were implementing Basel II. And then there was a clear desire, once you were in the club, to hire really good quants and quants that were better than the quants that the regulators had, so that you could drive down those capital requirements over time by finding tweaks in the model, ways of modeling data that would result in a lower capital requirement. And there was a lot of pressure put on quants and risk management teams to do that, to get the capital requirements down. You know, don't be conservative. You know, you've got a conservative assumption here, and you've got a conservative assumption here, and you've got another one over here, and it's just conservatism all the way. Take it all out. Let's be realistic about how much capital we need. Let's not shoot ourselves in the foot. So there was a very good chart that the regulators put out, I guess, in 2005-06, as we were leading up to what I would call Basel 3.1, being based in the UK. And what the international community or the sort of the Basel Committee would call finalising Basel III. But because Basel III had been all about, as you say, improving capital, so making sure banks had more capital and a higher quality of capital and capital that actually could absorb losses, because bear in mind, during the global financial crisis, a lot of the capital that banks had didn't absorb any losses at all. So it was about getting loss-absorbing capacity up. And, of course, TLAC added to that. So now, if you look at, you know, Lloyds Banking Group's TLAC requirement, it's around 30%. So that banking group has to have 30% effectively capital. Now, I know that you know, sort of senior unsecured debt isn't capital, but it is when you look at that sort of resolution framework. That money is there, and it's demonstrably there to absorb losses. So I think that's really what it was all about. That's what the sort of post-Basel III or the Basel III reforms were about, that and about making sure there was accountability in the financial system so that if something went wrong, the regulator could write a report and fine someone some money and fine a firm some money, and justice would be seen to be being done in the financial system. And we've seen that. We've seen senior executives being fined for various things that you might argue are either misconduct or recklessness or simply not following the rules. So that all came in place. But actually, no one believed RWAs because of these highly intelligent quants who had pushed down the risk weightings on all sorts of instruments. So Basel 3.1 is all about constraining that. It's all about saying, well, we don't believe the models. We shouldn't really have let banks do this. We're going to limit the benefit that can come from these models in future. And in doing so, there's a secondary objective, which is to to remove some of the penalties that not being an IRB bank force. I suppose it forces banks that aren't IRB banks to out of certain markets and into riskier markets. I think that's the thing. So if you look at, you know, the sort of biggest banks in the UK, and their mortgage portfolios tend to be sort of prime mortgages, you know, sort of below 70% LTV, you know, modest buy-to-let portfolios. If you look at a challenger bank, it's the opposite. They've got to have high LTV buy-to-lets, because that's the only way to get the kind of margin that you need to generate a similar return on capital to the big banks that they're getting from their sort of, you know, highly secure mortgages, but with an IRB model that says they only need, you know, 7, 8, 9% of the outstanding balance as capital. So yes, I mean, I think Basel 3.1 is essentially saying, you know, We need to put some constraint. We need to regulate what the banks are doing with internal models. We want them to have the models because it gives better risk management. There's a lot more data. Theoretically, it should predict when things are going to go wrong. So that's Basel 3.1. You can't have an operational risk model at all under Basel 3.1. There are still banks with advanced management approach models for Basel 3.1, but everyone's realised you can't model operational risk. So you can't model it in a way that's going to predict, because what kills you, you didn't know about. So it's very hard to predict how much capital you need to hold for operational risk. So that's been done away with. And of course, in market risk, market risk models are becoming much more conservative, and they're focused more on tail risk than they were before.
Because you mentioned in your early days you actually did do some modelling of operational risk, do you find that a difficult thing to say that you can't now model it, or did you realise that many years ago as well, and now it's become, or was it just become, has it just become more obvious as things have happened?
That's a really good question. So my job was to implement Basel rather than come up with the arguments for one model or another model. So I never had to sit in front of a regulator during the reviews, because they had to review under the rules. They had to review all the models and sign them off, because in Basel II, the rule was once you'd signed off a model, that was it. You know, it was then in force, and the regulator couldn't really ask you to change it after that, and they couldn't add Pillar 2 capital for it. So you had, you know, it was one chance for the regulator to review a model. So they did it quite thoroughly. But I never had to sit in front of a regulator and defend a model. So at HSBC, we had a team within operational risk. I think in the end, we only implemented the advanced approach in the US, but I can't quite remember. But I could never really get my head round the logic for how these models work. So initially, the idea was you just collect all your historic operational risk losses and you churn all those through a model, and it comes up with a curve. And I remember asking, and then you take the sort of 97th percentile or whatever the percentile is on that curve. And I remember talking to some very intelligent quant about this, and I was saying, well, how have you modelled operational risk? Well, we've come up with this curve. And I said, what curve is it? And they said, oh, it's called generalized Pareto distribution. And I thought, that's really interesting. He said, what we do is we use a log normal model for the first 90% of the curve. And then we use a generalized Pareto distribution for the rest of the curve. And I thought, wow, that's incredibly interesting. I'm going to go and sort of look this up. So I guess Google wasn't quite as good in those days, but I think I had a statistics course book at home or something like that. And I found out what a generalized Pareto distribution is. Do you know what it is, Chris? You probably do.
I wouldn't want to express exactly what it is, but I've heard the word as an economist previously when I was at university. Tell us, David.
As I understood it at the time, a generalized Pareto distribution, you take your log normal distribution for your first 90%, and then the point at where that stops, you then draw a line, a straight line to infinity. From that point, that's a generalized Pareto distribution. So it's a very technical term for saying, get your ruler out and draw a straight line. It's not to infinity, because that would be a horizontal line, but draw a straight line out to your 99.9999 percentile. And then you just read off that curve, the 97th percentile or whatever your confidence level is for capital, 99.9, and that's your capital number. Well, sorry, you know, are you really forecasting anything with that, or are you just drawing a straight line and triangulating your capital requirement? So I never really believed operational risk modeling, and neither did the regulators, and they introduced more and more scenario analysis. You know, what could go wrong, what's the frequency, what's the severity, and let's start to be more forward looking in our operational risk capital estimations. But I think they've just given up now. They've said, you can't do it, forget it, we're not going to bother anymore.
But interestingly, at the moment, correct me if I'm wrong, you know, one of the ways when you don't look at modelling operational risk, they sort of look at how much revenue you've had for the last few years, and you take a proportion of the revenue for operational risk. Now, a lot of banks have made increasing amounts of revenue just because interest rates have gone up. Even if you had half your balance sheet of the central bank paying you 0.1% in sterling a couple of years ago, now you're getting 5.25%. Suddenly, your operational risk has gone through the roof. Your bank, half your balance sheet still at the central bank, and it makes no difference whatsoever. So it's obviously, there's two sides of all of these stories, obviously. Are the losers in the end the quants here? Because is it worth doing too much modelling? Or not that it might be not worth doing modelling, but it might not be worth applying for a model and doing all the governance processes around the model. So you could run a much simpler model and still have your maybe a standardised approach. Because if the Basel floor hits you at 72.5, is there any point? And so why don't you cut the costs out of running these models with all these exceptionally talented, you know, probably former rocket scientists who have come to work for your institution?
I think it's much more complicated than rocket science. Rocket science is just Newtonian, isn't it? Just Newtonian mechanics, you know, point the rocket at the thing, the place where it's going to be, it's going to go up and it's going to go down. I think that's right. I think modeling, if I was a modeler today and you're either doing sort of market and counterparty risk, because there's still a genuine internal benefit to doing that modeling, or you're getting into AI and you're starting to think about how to build AI that might support treasury functions in the future, which fills me with horror. But I think that's right. I think the benefits of IRB are pretty scant for the remaining banks that need to or would want to implement it. And there are sort of three other considerations. I mean, one is Basel 3.1 does constrain the amount of benefit you can get from IRB models, but they've kind of set it at a level where there is still an incentive. So if you look at a bank with a sort of 12-13% capital ratio, a challenger bank in the UK, if it went on to an IRB on IRB models for credit risk, you know, that ratio could go up to 20-25%. So there's still, even under Basel 3.1, and it probably wouldn't, probably 15-16%, but that is a significant amount of capital that can be reinvested in the business, returned to shareholders, or provide a wonderful cushion for the inevitable next financial crisis. So I think it's worth doing. The other point to make about it is that the regulators kind of expect banks, once they get past a certain level, they raise an eyebrow and said, you really ought to be moving to IRB at this stage, oughtn't you? So even if there isn't, because so many banks are on IRB now, so many big banks are on IRB, even if there isn't much of a capital incentive to do it, there is definitely a sort of regulator Bank of England pressure on banks that are growing to do it because of the richness of MI that it provides both internally and to the regulator and investor community. So I think if you were a sort of 50 to 20 billion balance sheet bank in the UK today and you didn't have plans to go on IRB, I think you'd be there'd be one or two conversations at the Mansion House dinner.
Now, David, you mentioned a few moments ago that there's bound to be another crisis sooner or later. Do you have a view where you think that next crisis may be coming from? And do you think that's got a relationship to Treasury or actually not so much, really? We've done most of the work in the banks, in the Treasury departments, and we've got a lot of liquidity and funding and less leverage and more capital and more constrained RWAs. And, you know, there's not so much trading anymore going on, at least proprietary trading in the way you might previously have seen it. How do you think about the future from your perspective?
There's a really good Basel Committee report from about 2003-2004, where some clever regulators went off and did an analysis of the banking crises that had happened in sort of G20 countries over the previous 40 years or something like that. And their conclusion was that their conclusion was that 14 out of the 20 crises that they identified, and when they said crisis, you know, it's like the Swedish banking crisis of 1971, you know, and so on and so forth. But they said 14 out of the 20 banking crises happened because of a crash in property prices following a period of deregulation. And of course, 4 years later, we had the global financial crisis, which was entirely because of that. So I think the past always tells us how the future is going to behave is the next crisis going to come from property investing? You know, the pendulum swings one way and we say, well, we're not going to lend more than 60% on a CRE loan or 70% on a residential mortgage loan. And then, you know, gradually there's sort of governmental pressure or insurance companies come in or 95% mortgages. And suddenly you find yourself back in the position that say the UK was in when I started in banking in the late 80s, where the people had 100% mortgages, they had mortgage indemnity insurance from companies that no longer exist, and house prices fell by, well, in real terms, by 25 to 30%. Remember, we had high inflation at the time and high interest rate, so the actual fall was less than that, but the real fall was significant. The other thing about that, of course, was that the rules around foreclosure weren't as restrictive as they are today. I mean, banks are very, very reluctant to kick anyone out of their house. That wasn't the case in the early 90s. It was a terrible property crash. People lost their homes and lots of money. They were in negative equity for 5, 6, 7 years until house prices recovered. So I think the past normally dictates the future. So I think probably the thing to look out for is a period of deregulation where leverage in the property market goes up, whether it's commercial or residential, whether it's in this country or another country, and people start making a lot of money out of it. That's one thing to look out for. The other one is model risk. And I think really coming back to that point of AI entering treasury or entering banks generally, you know, it's clear that if everyone is working off the same or very similar computer programs, there is a huge risk of a huge concentration risk there, where everyone's AI is telling them to buy X and sell Y. And I can see the more and more reliant we become on AI and computers and models, the more likely that sort of coincidental risk is going to happen. Lastly, the fact that information is so readily available, and we saw this with SVB, that, you know, as soon as there's a doubt about a bank, there is the potential for a run on that bank. Deposit aggregators, social media, the fragility of banks, the fragility of the liquidity position of banks means that there needs to be some kind of new liquidity framework. And one of my favourite stories about HSBC is they were the de facto central bank in Hong Kong for a very long time. And there was a next door, if you go to Hong Kong, there's HSBC and right next door is Standard Chartered. And there was a run on Standard Chartered in the 60s. I think it was in the 60s, and I may be making this up, but there was a run on Standard Chartered, and people were queuing up outside the head office branch in Queen's Road Central in Hong Kong and taking wads of banknotes out and going next door and putting them into HSBC. And at the back of HSBC, there were sort of HSBC porters taking wheelbarrows of cash back round to Standard Chartered so they could continue to allow people to take out their deposits. And I think now, that might have been Hang Seng and not Standard Chartered, but anyway, I think it was Standard Chartered. And then, you know, and because of that, everyone calmed down and they were able to settle it all. And I sort of see liquidity. Banks need to stand alone from a liquidity perspective. But if they have a liquidity problem, I think the way it's handled at the moment through this sort of discount window and emergency funding, there must be a more gentle way of doing that. You know, this whole sort of wheelbarrows of cash approach. There must be a way for some sort of centralized liquidity pool to be able to be drawn down on, so that, because we know the money's moved somewhere else in the system, so there must be some way within reasonable bounds to access a sort of pooled liquidity facility. That doesn't mean that a bank with lots of capital and a good business model will have to go into resolution. I'll leave it to the regulatory community to figure out how that might work.
We've been at this for a while, and it's been incredibly interesting. So we'll start to draw it to a close. But there's a few sort of non-technical, non-banking topics that are maybe worth just discussing. For those listening to the podcast, David actually has 15 O-levels, I see. To start with, how do you actually manage to have 15 O-levels?
Very good. For most people listening, I should probably explain, or maybe, Chris, you'd like to explain what an O-level is.
I myself do have, this is the difference between myself and David, I have one O-level because I was virtually the first year of GCSEs, but I took my maths a year early, so I was able to have one O-level. I just say that O-levels were harder than GCSEs. Should we go with that? So just I always thought of it as a slightly harder version of GCSEs. Whatever you got in your GCSE, you would get one lower in O-level, a grade lower. That's how I felt about it, having taken both, but that's all I can add in this situation.
So the way to get a lot of O-levels, and indeed a lot of GCSEs, is to go to a school which has not a very good record of pass marks in O-levels or GCSEs. So I went to a now defunct independent school on the Isle of Wight that didn't have a particularly good academic record. And they said, oh, here's some guy who's could actually get some quite good grades. So they put me in for as many O-levels as they possibly could. So I think I took four O-levels in fourth form, which would be the equivalent of year 12, and then nine in the year when you're supposed to take them, and then another three after that in my lower sixth year. So one of the subjects is technical drawing. I've got an O-level in technical drawing. I've got an O-level called general paper. I can't even remember what that was. I think it was just, that was the O-level that they put the Tim Nice But Dims through, so that they had some sort of O-level. Religious studies, and then sort of maths, French, further maths, you know, whatever the other ones were, geography, history, biology. Yeah, 15 O-levels. It's a bit, I shouldn't really say that in my CV. I should take that off my CV and just say, a broad, rounded education. It's
well worth the discussion. What's the best Treasury-related book or Treasury-related paper you've ever read? Where would you push people?
Away from Treasury-related books and Treasury-related papers, actually. I think I'm not a big one for reading technical books because I think that's one person's view. I think it's much better to, As you sort of live through your career, to sort of be very aware of the things that are happening around you in the industry and reading up on them. So, you know, SVB and Credit Suisse, lots of articles about that, lots of eventually regulator reports about that. And it's really good to sort of read around those issues and understand them at the time and really try and read between the lines as well and try and figure out what's going on and why people are behaving the way they're behaving and why are they reacting the way they're reacting and how could anyone be so stupid is often a very good question to ask. When you look at SVB, for example, you know, a bank that was just growing incredibly fast, the regulators didn't really want to impose proper, you know, interest rate risk metrics on it because the Trump administration were telling them not to. And, you know, it's kind of crazy when you look at those sorts of bank collapses. And it was so obvious with hindsight that they were going to get into trouble. I mean, the last book I read was The Big Short. But I would say the best book I've read in about finance is also by Michael Lewis. Which I read when I first entered finance, which is Liar's Poker. It's a great read, you know, and it just gives you a sense of the environment that people were working in at that time. But a lot of that thought process is still there. If it's concealed behind governance, it's still there, I think.
Well, you've just reminded me, actually. So if anyone doesn't want to read The Big Short, they can always watch the film, which is available on Netflix and other places. And it reminds me of earlier on your discussion about one of the hedge fund managers was being overseen by his risk overseers, and he walked in, or he told his underling to walk into the risk managers and tell them to which you will see if you listen to the Big Talk. Now, well, we will bleep those two expletives out, I'm sure, at some point.
Yes.
Now, in terms of you work for HSBC. HSBC, for those that don't know, is a sort of federation of banks. It's got a name of HSBC on the top, but there's probably in the region of 70 banks that sit underneath that. David had a lot to do with sort of trying to coordinate and implement Basel II across these sort of 70 banks. So how did you, what tips can you give people around coordination around that many people across the world? Is there any good management tips on that?
Well, the number one is to work for a bank if you're in the same location as the head office, because it means everyone else around the world has to get up early or stay up late to join your meetings. So that's the most important thing. If you work for a US bank in the UK, you're in trouble. I think you can't beat getting around a table with a group of people. So actually, my lesson on Basel II was we used to fly a lot. I mean, I know it's not fashionable anymore and it's, budgets are tighter, but we used to fly a lot, or people used to fly to us, and we'd sit round a table and talk through issues. And I know Zoom is much, much better than anything. In those days, we just had these PZM microphones in the middle of the table, and we had to talk to people and we couldn't see them. Zoom's much better than that now. And you have these, and we have these sort of telepresence rooms and all sorts of other things where you can get the sense. But it doesn't work, I don't think. I think you've always got to get people together. And once you get them together and they know each other and they've gone out for dinner and worked through some issues in person, it's much, much easier then to go back to wherever you are and work together going forward. So I think the best way to do sort of virtual coordination is to meet in person at the start.
Have you got a sort of piece of advice for anyone, either graduates or anyone entering into this world? I suppose those are two separate questions, actually. What would you say about anyone? Would you get into stuff that you're interested in, good at? And if it turns out that is banking or treasury, any good piece of advice?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, because if I look back on myself, you sort of drift towards what you're good at, I think. You sort of arrive somewhere and you don't really know what you're good at. You don't really know what people are doing. And as you start to find out your job, you might find there are aspects of it that you really enjoy, and I would follow that. And you might find things that you really don't enjoy, and I would get away from that. But my advice more generally would be to, as far as you can, enjoy the process and enjoy the environment you're working in. There's not that many industries that are so, where there's so many column inches about what's going on, not just in the FT, but in lots of papers. You can read about companies, you can read about banks, you can read about blunders and regulatory fines and success stories every day. And I think that's the real skill, because you can easily get into a job in treasury where you're become a specialist in interest rate risk, or a specialist, I don't know, in collateral management, whatever it is. But actually understanding the big picture and what's going on behind the scenes makes it possible for you to talk to people, particularly senior people, but not just senior people, in a context, in a way that they understand. So if it's going to happen in the future, it's probably happened before. And I would focus on understanding what's gone well, what's gone badly. And that gives you so much better perspective on what you're doing within Treasury today.
And last piece for today, you know, there is a lot to read. There is a lot to look at all the time. There are emails coming in all the time, which means you can get slightly distracted from what you're trying to do. Are there any sort of good tips on organisation and time management that help you cope with this stuff? Anything that you might want to share?
What I've done, Chris, and I'm not particularly good at time management. I try and leave, you know, I like a deadline because it's very motivating to get beyond it before you start working on what you have to do. So a little bit of adrenaline and stress is great for getting stuff done. But in terms of time management, well, I guess it was probably about 2008, 2007. I learnt how to divert any email that wasn't addressed to me to another box. So if someone copied me, CC'd me, then it would go to another box and I'd review it if I had time. And I'd only look at the emails that were sent directly to me. And then, of course, I'd also look at the emails that were BCC'd to me, because those are probably the most important emails you get when you're working for a large bank. But number one is just to filter your email box, set up some rules and get rid of the spam. And then develop an argument or an expression on your face when someone says, well, I copied you on that. You say, well, I get copied on a lot of emails, you know. The other good thing about time management, the other big time management trick I learnt was converting Celsius to Fahrenheit, which is the actual conversion is you divide by 5, multiply by 9 and add 32. But the rule of thumb is double it and add 30. So whenever someone says, how long is it going to take you to do something? You double it and add 30 minutes. And that normally gives you enough time to accommodate all the things that go wrong as you're trying to do your piece of work, all the distractions and everything else. Or expectation management is at least 80% of the skill of getting things done on time.
Now, when we started this conversation or this podcast beforehand, we were having a discussion between myself and David as to how long we'd go on for. And we talked about 30 minutes. But with the rule of thumb, we've probably doubled it and add 30. So I think at this stage,
very good.
We probably will draw this to a close. David, thank you very much for your insights and clarity. That's really
it's a pleasure.
And for those that are taking the certificate of Bank ALM, you'll get to the pleasure of hearing more from David. And those that have never taken it, there you go. This is the kind of insights you get. So David, thank you for your time today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much, Chris. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Treasury Matters. We hope you enjoyed it. Look out for more episodes coming from us soon. And in the meantime, why don't you follow us on your favourite podcast app?